It's not a capricious choice, I say, although I can't remember exactly what the word means.
Okay,
he says, pulling a bag of hot dog buns out of the bread drawer.
Tell me again, then, one more time. What's so special about Pete? Why him?
Why not? I say, unable, or maybe just unwilling, to articulate my gut feeling about using Pete.
That's your answer?
He gives me an incredulous stare as he tosses a bun at me. I miss it and watch it land on the kitchen floor.
Yep,
I say. I pick it up and put it on my plate, deciding to go with the 5-second rule.
That's my answer.
On Friday morning, after Gabe and I both call in sick to work, we walk into a nondescript midtown office building for my appointment with Susan Lazarus. As we sit in the waiting room, I fill out endless forms, answering exhaustive questions about my medical history, while Gabe plays solitaire on his phone. At one point, I glance over his shoulder and read a text from Leslie that says, "Where are you?" "With Josie," he writes back, which both surprises me and piques my curiosity enough to covertly read the rest of the conversation in real time. "Oh, at lunch?"
"No, just out and about."
"Can you call me?"
"Can't at the moment, but will in about 30?
"Sure. I am Y." Out of the corner of my eye, I see him smile, then type, "I am Y too." At this point, he catches me reading over his shoulder.
"Nosy,"
he says, tilting his phone away from me, just as my name is called by a young woman in lavender scrubs. I stand and look at Gabe. "You coming?"
"You want me to?"
"I want you to," I say. A moment later, we are ushered into a small office. A diminutive woman with a pixie cut sits behind a large antique desk that seems too heavy and ornate for her. She stands and says,
"Josephine?"
"Josie," I say, nodding.
"Josie,"
she repeats, giving me a warm smile.
"Please come in. I'm Susan Lazarus."
I like her immediately, perhaps because she uses her first name, and I smile back at her as we shake hands. "This is Gabe," I say. She nods, shakes his hand, then tells us to please take a seat, gesturing to the chairs across from her desk.
"So," she says brightly, "what brings you here today?"
"Well, I want a baby," I say, overcome by a sudden rush of excitement. She gives me an even wider smile, then says,
"Well, you've come to the right place. So, tell me, Josie, have you been trying to conceive?"
I shake my head and say, "No, not at all. I'm not married. I'm single. I want to use a sperm donor." She nods, completely unfazed.
"Perfect," she says, then turns to Gabe. "And will you be donating your sperm?" "Nope," he says. "I'm just here for moral support."
"That's wonderful," she says, "and so very important given Josie's journey ahead." She turns back to me and says,
"Have you thought about your donor?"
"Yes," I say. "I've been reading and researching quite a bit."
"Good," she murmurs, nodding. "And tell me about that."
"Well, I've read a lot about sperm banks, women who have gone that route, children who were conceived that way, and I don't have a problem with it. I get that it's more straightforward, with fewer strings attached. But I just think that I'd like to use acquaintance sperm," I say, exchanging a look with Gabe.
"You mean the sperm of an acquaintance?" she asks with a calm poker face.
"Yes, a guy I've recently met. I guess you could call him a friend," I say. "Do you think that's a bad idea?"
"I think this is entirely a personal decision. A very personal decision."
Gabe makes an exasperated sound and says,
"But aren't there a lot of risks to doing this with some guy she barely knows?"
"There are pros and cons to every reproductive scenario," Dr. Lazarus replies.
"We believe in helping women make a choice that is right for them, and supporting that choice, both medically and legally. We have a family law practice we work closely with. They can help you draw up a contract that works for you. And of course, we would handle the insemination in the office."
"See?" I say, looking at Gabe jubilant. "I told you if I do it at the doctor's office, it's foolproof."
"I wouldn't say foolproof," she interjects, Nothing is ever foolproof when it comes to the ever-shifting body of reproductive law. But the way we handle it is as close to ironclad as you can get. And we've done it that way for many women.
I glance at Gabe, who crosses his arms in not-so-subtle protest.
Of course, there are emotional issues that can't be provided for in a contract. And it sounds as if that might be your concern,
she continues, now looking at Gabe.
Yes, as a matter of fact, it is my concern,
he says, nodding.
What if this guy she barely knows turns out to be crazy, and he won't leave her or her kid alone? What then?
Well, that could happen with any guy, I say, turning to him. And I'd handle it the same way I would if I were dating the guy and he turned crazy, with a restraining order.
You'd be okay getting a restraining order against the father of your kid?
Gabe's voice is slightly raised and agitated.
He wouldn't be the father, I say.
Right. He'd just be the creepy sperm donor you got a restraining order against,
Gabe says with a shrug.
No biggie.
Before I can reply, Dr. Lazarus clears her throat and tentatively interrupts our sidebar.
Might I make a suggestion?
You may, I say, feeling fairly confident that she will be on my side.
Let's focus on you, Josie, she says, pointing at me, because we know that part of the equation.
We know you want to use one of your eggs and carry your child, correct?
Yes, I say, nodding emphatically.
We do know that.
So, let's focus on your preconception care and check for any potential risks to you during your pregnancy.
I tell Dr. Lazarus that I think that's a fabulous idea. She continues earnestly.
No matter which donor sperm you decide to use, we want you to be your healthiest self, both physically and emotionally.
I nod, feeling another burst of excitement, as Gabe manages to look slightly less glum. We both watch and listen as Dr. Lazarus puts on her reading glasses, glances through my forms, and begins to ask detailed follow-up questions about my health history. She then asks me if it's okay if Gabe stays while we discuss my reproductive history. I tell her yes, he can hear anything. We're best friends. She smiles, nods, then asks if I've ever been pregnant before.
A few scares, I say with a laugh, but no.
So no miscarriages? I shake my head.
I don't think so. I mean, occasionally I'm a little late and have a really heavy period, and sometimes I wonder if that could be a miscarriage. But no, I don't think so.
I glance at Gabe, who grimaces, then crosses his arms, as Dr. Lazarus continues to ask questions about my cycle, menstrual history, vaccinations, and contraceptive use. I tell her I have a very regular 28-day cycle, that I'm all up to date on my vaccinations, that historically I have been on the pill and use condoms, though I went off the pill a few weeks ago and have not been sexually active in several months.
Any abnormal pap smears?
Just one, I say. It turned out to be nothing, though. Just a yeast infection.
Alrighty then, Gabe says under his breath. Can I please wait out there?
No, I hiss, glaring at him. You can't. Gabe sighs and stares at the ceiling as Dr. Lazarus segues into a conversation about nutrition and exercise, alcohol, and nicotine. I tell her I don't smoke, but I do drink socially. She nods.
Okay, a glass of wine here and there is fine before conception, but try to limit it to that.
What about coffee? I ask.
I recommend limiting your caffeine to 300 milligrams per day, so about 2 8-ounce cups.
I get out my pad and start to take a few notes, but she reassures me that all the advice will be on my printed materials.
I'll also give you a prescription for a prenatal vitamin, as you will need plenty of folic acid. Additionally, you should make sure you're eating a variety of foods rich in fiber, calcium, and other nutrients. Avoid sugar and processed foods. You just want to be as healthy as you possibly can to get your body ready for pregnancy.
Okay, I say, feeling determined. Gabe's a great cook, and we live together.
Well, that's a big help, she says, smiling at him, then me.
I smile back at her.
So is that it?
Almost, she says. I'd like to do a quick physical exam, and then we're going to take some labs.
Gabe looks horrified.
You may skip the exam,
Dr. Lazarus tells him with a smile. She stands, walks around the desk, and shakes his hand.
It was very nice to meet you, Gabe. Josie's lucky to have you in her life.
The comment seems to catch him off guard, but he mumbles a polite thank you.
I trust you'll help her make a sound decision about her next steps, she says.
I hold my breath, awaiting his response, half expecting something snarky to come out of his mouth. Instead, he simply nods and says,
Yes, I will. We just want a healthy baby. Right, Josie?
He turns to look at me. I swallow, feeling a little teary, then tell him yes, that's all we want.
Chapter 20. Meredith. Nolan and I barely talk the week following our anniversary, and when we do, our exchanges are strained and formal. I'm not sure whether I'd call it a stalemate or a standoff or simply the calm before the storm, but I find myself seriously contemplating his suggestion that I go to New York. I can't imagine leaving Harper for more than a few days, but the prospect of spending some time alone becomes something of an obsession. It doesn't help my mental state that I've just been staffed on a mammoth product liability case with Larry Goldman, the biggest asshole partner in the firm, who gave me a scathing review last year because I dared to miss a deposition when I came down with a 103-degree fever. When I give Ellen the update over the phone one morning, she tells me I'm welcome to stay at her apartment in the city. Are you sure? I ask. Of course, she says. Absolutely. Oh, thank you. It would only be for a few days. Stay as long as you want. Stay a week. I don't know. I think I'd feel too guilty leaving Harper for longer than a couple of nights. You shouldn't feel guilty, Ellen says. I'm often gone from Eastlow a week at a time, and she's totally fine with Andy and his parents. That's different. You're actually working, I say. Yes, but we all need time to ourselves sometimes, Ellen says. It doesn't make you a bad mother. Maybe not, I say, thinking that it might not make me a bad mother, but I'm pretty sure the way I'm feeling does make me a lousy wife. The following Monday, I call in the big guns and meet with Amy, telling her everything I told Ellen, only more candidly. She listens intently, then says, Why New York? I frown, thinking for a few seconds before I say, I don't know why Nolan suggested New York. Maybe because that's where I lived when we started to date? Maybe because he knows I'd have a free place to stay there. My friend Ellen has an apartment. Honestly, though, it doesn't have to be New York. I just want to get away. From him, from work, even from Harper. I wait for a lofty psychological explanation, something about how common my feeling is among mothers with young children. Instead, she simply says, You should do it, Meredith. You should go. Now. She looks into my eyes with her trademark confident, clear-eyed stare. My heart skips a beat. Really? Yes. Really, she nods again, her bob in full motion. And do what exactly? I say, wanting to be clear about the permission slip she's signing for me. Take a vacation. Maybe even a short leave of absence, as Nolan suggested. Go to New York. Alone. I shake my head. They'll never let me leave. Especially now that I'm on this big case. Yes, they will, she says. Especially if you tell them you need the time for your health. You mean, imply I have cancer or something? I look at her appalled. No, I'm talking about your mental health, which can be just as critical. I sigh, considering the implications. If I admit to some mental problem, then I'll never make partner, even if I go back to full time. First of all, they legally can't hold that against you. Second of all, I didn't realize that making partner was your dream, she says, calling my bluff, because she knows that making partner has never been something I cared much about. I mean, it would be a satisfying accomplishment, It would translate to more money, and it would make my parents very, very proud. But basically, I'm perfectly fine as a senior associate. It's not my dream, I say. You know that. Well, then, what's your next excuse? I stare at her, my heart now racing. It was one thing when Nolan told me to go to New York, and even Ellen. It's another thing altogether hearing it from Amy. I guess I don't have one, I say. Okay, then. Tell your firm you need some time off. They'll put someone else on this case. You're replaceable. What if I'm so replaceable that they fire me? She shakes her head, adamant. They wouldn't do that, especially not if you cite your health. But who knows? Maybe you'll quit when you get home. Maybe, I say, wondering why I haven't already. Was it nerve that I lacked, or simply a viable alternative? There's really no downside here, Amy says. So go home and book your flight, pack your bags, and head to New York City for a week, or three. 3 weeks? I say, her advice suddenly sounding so rash and extreme that I fleetingly question everything she's telling me. That's out of the question. I could never be gone from Harper for longer than a week. Besides, wouldn't that constitute abandonment? Amy shakes her head. Absolutely not. A few weeks away does not an abandonment make. And after all, it was Nolan's idea. Your husband made you the very kind offer to take some time to think. I interrupt her, shaking my head. I wouldn't call it kind. I'd call it passive-aggressive. I actually don't think he thinks I'll do it. All the more reason, she says. How do you figure? Because. This is just another sign that you aren't on the same page. He's challenging you. Your love for your family. Maybe even your mothering. Okay, so doesn't going to New York simply prove to him that I'm somehow inadequate? Do you feel inadequate? Amy asks. I consider the question carefully, then say, sometimes. Yes. Because you need some time to yourself? Well, yeah, I say, biting my lip. Because I want to be alone. Among other reasons. Amy pushes her hair behind one ear, then the other, and says my name calmly, reassuringly. Meredith. All mothers occasionally fantasize about an escape, taking some time off. You, however, are in the unique position to actually take that time. You have financial security, and a husband who has given you his permission, albeit passive-aggressive permission. So go. Think. Decide what it is you want and need. Maybe it's a divorce. Maybe it's a new career. Maybe it's nothing more than a little time to yourself and a fresh perspective on things. Regardless, I do believe that you'll be an even better mother on the other end of some reflection. I smile, grateful for the inclusion of the word even. I tell myself that I am a pretty good mother. Otherwise, I might have been long gone by now. If you end up happier, this could really be a gift to Harper in the long run. Maybe, I say, frowning as I picture my daughter's face peering at me in her darkened bedroom, telling me that she needs another story, a drink of water, or simply a mommy cuddle. She can't even fall asleep in her own bed if I'm not sitting in the rocking chair beside her. How will she ever be okay for a week or more without me? I suddenly shift gears, fast-forwarding years from now, picturing Harper as a young woman sitting in an office like this one while she discusses her deep-seated issues, how they all stem from the time her mother left her when she was only 4. I hear Amy say my name. I look at her. Hmm? What are you thinking? She asks. I don't know, I say, shaking my head. I just don't know if I can do this. Yes, you can, she says. I take a deep breath, then exhale as Amy reassures me that Harper will be fine. She'll be with her father and grandparents and aunt in competent, loving hands. I wouldn't call my sister particularly competent, I say, but feel my first real urge to talk to her since our fight, if only for Harper's sake. Harper will be fine, Amy says again. And you, Meredith, need to find a way to be fine, too. The next morning, I wake up and decide to go for it. Take Nolan's dare, Ellen's offer, Amy's advice, and most important, follow my own gut. I take a shower, put on my best black suit and heels, and get to the firm early, even before the most dogged associates with no children or personal lives. I head straight for my office and promptly begin to take inventory of my cases, realizing with some mixed feelings that Amy is right. I am indispensable on absolutely nothing. A very small, insignificant, albeit overworked cog. About an hour later, I work up the nerve to send an email to our managing partner, Mike Molo, requesting a short meeting with him. I am pretty sure Molo has no clue who I am, our only real interaction occurring on the elevator when he asked me to push the button for floor 16, one above mine. So I'm flabbergasted when I spot him in the hallway outside my office, reading my nameplate, an expendable red-weld file in one hand, a Starbucks venti in the other. After confirming that he has the correct, utterly replaceable associate, he takes a sideways step, now filling my doorway, and says, "Good morning, Meredith." "Good morning, Mike," I say, my heart pounding as I stand to meet his gaze. "You wanted to talk about something?" he asks, his voice as imposing as his frame. "Yes, yes, I do. But I would have come to you," I stammer. "It's okay. I was in the neighborhood. Why don't we have a seat?" he says, pointing to my desk chair. I sit back down as he walks the rest of the way into my office, glances around the crammed quarters, then eases himself into the chair across from my desk. "So, what's up?" he asks, taking a long sip of coffee, as if we're old pals, or at least equals. I take a deep breath and give him my rehearsed opener. "Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I've been working at this firm for more than 7 years, and that I've had mostly excellent reviews. And I have met or exceeded my billable requirements every year, both as a full-time associate and after my daughter was born as a part-time associate."
"Yes, you have an excellent reputation. Thank you for your fine work and commitment," he nods, looking serious.
But I detect a sparkle of something in his eyes. He knows what's coming, and is somehow amused by it.
"So, what are you working on these days?" he asks.
"The Lambert case," I say, trying, likely unsuccessfully, to hide my distaste. "Pretty much exclusively." He whistles, then winces.
"Ooh, sorry to hear that. Goldman's a real charmer, isn't he?"
"Yes," I say, giving him a genuine smile. "He is indeed." Molo grins, then says,
"So is that what you wanted to talk to me about? Goldman?"
"Oh, no, not exactly. Actually, not at all," I babble. "I just wanted to talk about work in general."
"Okay, let's cut to the chase. Are you resigning or just requesting a leave of absence?"
He takes his last sip of coffee, then aims the cup toward my wastebasket, a full 4 or 5 feet away. He makes the shot, then says,
"Because I would really recommend the latter."
Stunned, I say, "Yes, sir. The latter. I would love the latter."
"How long do you want?" he asks.
2 weeks? Maybe 3. He raises his brows and says,
"You sure that's all?"
3 would be amazing. Molo nods, then says,
"How about a month?"
My smile turns into a grin. "Thank you so much. A month would be amazing."
"Fabulous. Enjoy," he says, glancing at his watch, then abruptly standing. "Just tell Goldman and HR I signed off on this. See you in a month. I hope you come back. But Godspeed either way."
Then, before I can thank him, let alone process the magnitude of the gift he's just bestowed upon me, my boss's boss winks and walks out the door.
Chapter 21, Josie. The Wednesday morning following my first appointment with Susan Lazarus, and 3 days before I turn 38, Gabe walks into the kitchen with an extreme case of bedhead. "Nice hair," I say. He runs his hand through it and thanks me. "Why are you up?" I ask, glancing at the clock on the microwave. It's only 6:40, about 5 minutes before I have to walk out the door, but a good hour before Gabe normally hits his snooze button for the first time.
"I wanted to catch you before you left,"
he says, yawning as he opens the refrigerator. He pulls out a jug of grapefruit juice, gives it a shake, then pours some into a glass.
"Your birthday's coming up."
"I thought you forgot," I say.
"I did, until this morning,"
he confesses without a trace of remorse.
"Why didn't you remind me like you usually do?"
I put my peanut butter toast down on a paper towel, wipe my fingers on the edge of it, and say, "I'm trying to be less self-involved as I approach motherhood."
"And how's that going for you?"
he asks, rubbing his eyes. "It's not easy," I say. "I was starting to feel like Samantha Baker."
"Who?"
he asks, which surprises me. Normally, he nails movie trivia.
"Come on, Molly Ringwald, 16 Candles. Remember how everyone forgot her birthday?" "Facebook wouldn't let that happen to you."
"You're not on Facebook."
"But I'm sure Pete is."
He gives me a coy look, clearly testing me.
"Good point," I say. "So, do you have plans with him?"
"No, I don't have any plans," I say, making a big show of taking my folic acid-filled vitamin with a long swallow of now room-temperature green tea.
"Well, what do you want to do?"
he asks. I think for a second and say, "I want to go out and get really drunk."
"Spoken like a mother."
"It'll be my last hurrah. Hopefully my last birthday without a child. Will you make a reservation somewhere fun?"
"Can't Sydney handle that?"
"Gabe," I whine. "She's not my best friend. You are."
"Fine,"
he says with a sigh.
"But can I get some guidance? Where do you want to go and who do you want to invite?"
"I'm sure you'll make the right decisions," I say. Then in case that's not enough pressure, I add, "You're the one person who never lets me down."
"Okay," he says. "Just send me Donor Boy's number. I assume you want him there?"
"Sure," I say. "That'd be great."
"How's his sperm count doing anyway?"
"Well, let's see. He switched from briefs to boxers, he gave up cycling, and he's avoiding the sauna and hot tub. The boys function best at 94 to 96 degrees," I say, gathering up my things.
"Tell me you're kidding."
"I am kidding, but I give him a shrug, enjoying the rare role reversal. Usually, I'm the gullible, confused one." Gabe mumbles something under his breath about me being insane as I head out the door, feeling inexplicably triumphant. Oddly enough, Dr. Lazarus leaves me a message later that morning, saying that she got my test results and would like for me to call her back at my convenience. I listen to it twice, and although her voice is perfectly neutral, my heart fills with dread and despair. I feel certain that she's going to give me disastrous news and can barely keep it together during my ensuing science lesson on the differences between solids, liquids, and gases. The second the school day ends, I call her back, launching right in with, "Just give it to me straight. I can't have a baby, can I? I need to start looking into adoption." She pauses for a few horrifying seconds, then laughs and says,
"Not at all, Josie. It's not that dire."
"Not that dire?" I say.
"It's not dire at all."
I blink back tears of relief as she calmly continues, "You're fine, just fine, and very healthy."
"So I can have a baby?"
"Yes, you should be able to have a baby, but your ovarian reserve result, which measures the quantity and quality of your eggs and is a major indicator of fertility, is a bit on the low side for your age."
"So I'm more like 40 than 38?
"Something like that," she says, with what I can tell is a smile. "It's nothing to panic about, but at the same time, if this is something you're really certain about,
I don't think you should wait for very long.
Like, how long do I have? I say.
It's not that scientific, she says. But if I were you?
Yes, I say, putting all my faith in her reply. If you were in my shoes, what would you do?
I would start trying immediately, she says, as soon as you make your donor decision.
Okay, I tell her, instantly picturing Pete. I will. That night, just after I've given Gabe the update on my ovarian reserve, Pete calls to chat. Although we've been talking on the phone fairly regularly, there's still a little nervous energy when we do. Both of us are working to be witty, as is often the case with new friends, regardless of gender, and whether one is considering donating his sperm to the other. About 10 minutes into our conversation, he mentions that Gabe called him about going out on Saturday night.
Oh, yeah. I know it's last minute, but 38 isn't a birthday to get too excited about, I say, thinking that that's especially true when your eggs are more like 40.
No worries if you have plans.
I try to sound more nonchalant than I feel. I'm in, he quickly says.
I smile and tell him good. I'm glad to hear it.
I've been thinking about what to get you, he says.
Oh, you don't have to get me anything. Your presence is present enough, I joke.
Incidentally, Meredith actually included that line on Harper's last birthday invitation, which I thought was a little bit pretentious. I mean, please, just let people get your kid a $20 gift already.
Oh, is it? Pete asks. That, and your sperm, I add with a laugh.
Just tell me when and where to make the deposit, he says.
I know it's only banter, but I seize the opportunity to tell him about my doctor's appointment last week. They call it prenatal consultation, I say. It was interesting. I really, really liked the doctor, Susan Lazarus. She was very nice, very smart. Gabe liked her too, and he's harder to please. I bite my lip to halt the babbling, deciding not to tell him about my test results.
Cool. So are you thinking of using Gabe now? Pete asks, for your donor?
Oh, God, no. Not at all. Never. He just went for moral support. I take a deep breath and add, I told Dr. Lazarus about you, actually.
Oh, you did you?
He says, sounding flattered. Yeah, I told her that I had an excellent prospect. My voice trails off as I wonder how I'm ever going to take this conversation to the next level.
And? He asks.
And she listened, I say with a nervous laugh.
So, would you want to meet her?
Sure, he says, without a second of hesitation.
When?
At my next appointment, I say, now sweating. I pick up the brochure that Dr. Lazarus gave me and start fanning myself with it.
Sure, he says again. So would it be like a preliminary interview, or more like a look at porn and ejaculate into a vial kind of deal?
Come on, I say, pretending to be offended. That's disgusting.
Sorry, but isn't that how it works?
I guess, I say, but can I make one request?
Go ahead, though something tells me that it won't be your last.
I really don't want to know if porn is part of my journey to motherhood, I say, laughing.
Fair enough, he says. I'll light some candles and bring some roses and think romantic thoughts instead.
I smile and tell him that's a much better visual. Thank you.
No problem, he says. Oh, and Josie?
Yeah?
You're welcome to join me, he says jokingly.
Ha ha, I say, pretending that my heart didn't just skip a beat. On Saturday morning, my actual birthday, I wake up in a good mood and feel even happier when Gabe comes into my room and informs me that we have a reservation at the Optimist at 8.
Perfect, I say as I start to make my bed.
Who all's coming?
Gabe gives me a cagey look and says, I thought you wanted to be surprised.
I never said that. I said I wanted you to handle the details, I say.
Well, I did handle them.
And?
He sits backward on my desk chair, Fonzie style, and says, It's me, you, Leslie, Sydney, Meredith, Shauna, and Donor Boy.
Interesting, I say, freezing in mid-pillow fluff.
Okay, Gabe says with a sigh. What's your beef?
I have several beefs, Leslie among them, but simply say, Meredith's coming?
Yeah, she texted me yesterday and asked.
He says,
I had to include her.
What about Nolan? Gabe shakes his head and says he can't make it.
Why not?
I ask, feeling disappointed that he can't be their family representative, and also a little worried that he might be mad at me, too. That my sister managed to rile him up and somehow turn him against me. I remind myself that this hasn't happened to date, so I'm probably okay now.
Meredith didn't say, Gabe replies.
What about Stacy, Kendra, and Lee? I ask, referring to my three closest college friends, none of whom Gabe particularly likes.
Did you invite them?
He pauses, then confesses.
You left it up to me, so I might have exercised a little bit of discretion.
I cross my arms and whine his name. Gabe isn't having it.
Look, do you have any idea how hard it is to get a table for 7 people at the Optimist on 3 days' notice? Can you just focus on the positive here?
It's not so hard when you've had relations with the head bartender, I say. Gabe gives me a sheepish look.
That was a long time ago.
That you had sex with her or that she sent you a naked selfie? I ask, remembering how I accidentally glimpsed a rather spectacular full-frontal nude of her on his phone.
Both,
he says, cracking his knuckles. But that is how you scored a last-minute reservation, I say, isn't it? He smirks.
Maybe.
I roll my eyes and ask if Leslie knows about her.
Yes, Leslie knows I'm friends with a bartender at the Optimist.
No, Gabe, we are friends.
That was something else altogether.
But whatever, I say, then switch gears. So Shauna's coming?
Yep, Meredith's idea. She gave me her number.
Huh, I say, a little surprised. Even though Shauna and I both made an effort to repair our friendship after Daniel died. It has been several years since she joined one of my birthday outings.
When's the last time you talked to her?
He asks. It's been a few months, and I don't think I've seen her since Oliver was born.
I figured it had been a while. She asked if you were seeing anyone.
What did you tell her?
I told her no.
Did you tell her anything about Pete?
No, he says. How do you plan on introducing everyone to him anyway?
Like this, I say, pausing for dramatic effect. Pete, meet Meredith, Sydney, and Shauna. Ladies, meet my sperm donor. Gabe shakes his head, muttering that I have serious issues, as he stands and walks toward the doorway. I clear my throat and say, did you forget something?
Oh, yeah,
he says, glancing over his shoulder.
Happy birthday, Samantha.
Thanks, Ducky, I say with a grin.
Ducky's in Pretty in Pink, he says,
stepping into the hallway, then turning toward the stairs.
Get your brat pack flick straight.
Well then, thanks, Long Duck Dong, I shout after him. That evening, Gabe and I take an Uber to the Optimist, well ahead of our reservation. We sit at the bar, eating oysters and drinking champagne, as we wait for the others to arrive, getting progressively more buzzed. Leslie shows up first, upstaging me in a clingy black dress with a plunging neckline, which, with her flat chest, creates a kind of Kate Moss effect. I chalk the wardrobe choice up to jealousy over the bartender and tell myself to give her a chance. As Gabe stands, kisses her cheek, and offers his stool. She refuses it, saying she's fine standing, then turns to wish me a happy birthday. Have you had a good day? She asks, giving me a hesitant hug. I nod and say I have, that I went shopping, then got a manicure. I hold up my fire engine red nails, which she promptly compliments, although she doesn't seem like the red nail type. She puts her clutch on the bar, covertly but furtively glancing behind it. Don't worry, I say with a smile.
The hoe's off tonight.
To Leslie's credit, she doesn't play dumb, but laughs and says, Oh, good. Besides, you're way prettier, I say, which is actually true.
You totally are,
Gabe says, nodding earnestly. Leslie laughs again and says, You have to say that. No. I say, shaking my head. Gabe's painfully honest.
And that's a bad thing? He asks.
I ignore his question and look at Leslie. Just don't ever ask him if something makes you look fat. Not that you could ever look fat, but still.
Hold the phone, birthday girl. I have never told you that you look fat, not one time,
Gabe says, then shifts his gaze to Leslie.
She's always asking whether I can tell she's gained weight. Sometimes I can't. Sometimes I can, but I've never called her fat.
All right, fair enough, I acquiesce, as Leslie gushes about how refreshing it is to be with an honest man. I nod in agreement, deciding that they really are a pretty cute couple, though they could almost pass for brother and sister.
You two look sort of related, I blurt out.
Gabe shrugs, throws his arm around Leslie and says,
Yeah, well, what's sexier than dating yourself?
The bartender comes by and I order an old salty dog, a vodka and grapefruit cocktail. I warn Leslie that they go down like water as she orders one too. By the time Sydney, Shauna, and Pete walk in, pretty much all at the same time, I can hear myself starting to slur my words a tiny bit as I make the requisite introductions. A moment later, just after Gabe hands me his glass of water and discreetly suggests that I slow down, the hostess finds us at the bar and leads us to our table. I slide into the middle of the banquet. Sydney and Pete end up on either side of me, Gabe, Leslie, and Shauna across from us, which leaves the awkward seventh chair on the end for Meredith, should she ever decide to show.
So happy you all came tonight, I announce, overcome with a warm feeling of affection for everyone at the table.
I tack on a special postscript for Shauna.
Thanks for making the effort. I know it's hard when you have a baby, and I really appreciate it. Please thank Lars for me, too, I say, knowing that her husband is home with their son.
It's our pleasure, she says, reaching across the table for my hand.
She gives it a little squeeze, followed by a smile that reminds me of the way things used to be between us, like she's about to share a very juicy tidbit of gossip. Instead, she turns her gaze to Pete, staring at him through funky, dark-rimmed glasses.
So, how did you and Josie meet? She asks. Are you a teacher, too?
Pete shoots me a fleeting glance, clearly looking for guidance. But when I provide him none, he simply says,
No, I'm a physical therapist, actually.
Oh, she says, nodding enthusiastically.
Do you have a specialty?
Sports and orthopedics, he says. He works with a few Braves players, I brag. She looks impressed, as he modestly adds,
ex-Braves.
As we all begin to peruse our menus, I decide to blurt out my news. So, Pete's also going to be my sperm donor, I announce. Sydney claps and lets out a jubilant yelp. Gabe rolls his eyes and shakes his head. And Shauna, after a glance at Pete, confirming that I'm not joking, begins to fire questions at me. Pete and I answer together as he repeats what he said more than once. That he wants to help me and do something good with his life. That he thinks he has pretty good genes. That he would love to have a relationship of some kind with my kid, but that he will respect my decision regarding his involvement. Shauna listens intently, without a visible trace of judgment or condescension. Although, at one point, she murmurs how absolutely fantastic it all is. I wonder if she might be overcompensating a little. At the very least, I bet she's relieved that she's not in my shoes. Regardless, I appreciate her supportive reaction and tell her as much, openly contrasting it to Meredith's. As Gabe chimes in, Sydney jabs me with her elbow and announces,
Shh, she's coming.
Sure enough, I look up and see my sister marching toward the table, wearing a big scowl and the most boring outfit imaginable, dark jeans, a plain black tank, and her standard Manolo pumps, which would be okay, except she gets them in a too short heel height. The only thing worse, the dreaded kitten heel. Her only accessories are stud earrings, her wedding ring, and a watch. Yawn.
Sorry I'm late, she says when she gets to the table.
She hands me a gift bag stuffed with tissue paper and says happy birthday. She then crouches slightly to give me a stiff, awkward hug, patting my shoulders twice.
Thanks, I say, taking the bag, then pointing to her chair. You're over there. She takes a step in that direction, then stops, looks at Pete, and introduces herself.
I'm Meredith, Josie's sister, she says formally, extending her hand.
Hi, I'm Pete, he says, shaking it.
Hi, Pete. I think I heard about your heroic efforts at Bistro Nico. She takes her seat, looking pleased with herself for having this nugget of information, probably because she knows I'm wondering how she heard it. Pete laughs modestly and says he'd hardly call a slap on the back heroic.
Certainly not like donating sperm, Sydney tees me up with a big grin, practically rubbing her hands together.
Oh, yes. I was just telling Shauna that Pete plans to donate his sperm to me, I say, looking straight at Meredith. My sister slides her chair in closer to the table and flashes a prim smile, her hands folded in her lap.
Yes, Mom told me about your donor. I didn't realize you were the same Pete, she says breezily, then looks up at our waiter, who has returned to take our drink orders, and asks for a Coke Zero.
You don't want a glass of wine? I ask, not trying to hide my annoyance.
She shakes her head and says,
Unfortunately, no. I'm not drinking tonight. We have early church tomorrow, Harper singing in the cherub choir.
Of course, any announcement containing the words church and cherub when you're out to dinner has a fun sponging effect, and I'm forced to go in the opposite direction, instructing our waiter that we'd love to kick things off with a round of tequila shots. He smiles, nods, and glances around the table.
So, 7 shots?
No, 6, Meredith quickly corrects him.
No, 7, I say. I'll take hers.
Despite Meredith's best buzzkill efforts, my birthday dinner is a blast. I can tell Shauna and Sydney both really like Pete, and even Gabe seems to put aside our reproductive controversy for the evening. He is loose and happy, cracking jokes and telling stories, which is not his usual style. At one point, Sydney makes this observation and jokingly asks Gabe if Leslie deserves the credit for his improved mood. He nods with a little smile and says,
Yeah, maybe so.
Totally so, I say, deciding to throw Leslie a bone. I turn to her and add,
You're good for him.
She smiles, reaches for his hand, and says,
You think so?
Yes, I say, but here's the real test. Can you get him to go to Johnny's Hideaway tonight?
Sydney laughs, knowing of my secret agenda to end up at one of my favorite, and Gabe's least favorite, venues in town.
Hell no, he says. No fucking way.
Who's Johnny? Pete asks.
You don't know Johnny's Hideaway? I say. And you've lived in Atlanta for how long?
4 years, he says. And no, never heard of it.
Me neither, Leslie says.
You're missing absolutely nothing, Gabe informs them. Is it a bar? Pete asks.
It's a nightclub, I say, and an Atlanta institution.
Please, Gabe says. It's a creepy midlife crisis meat market where you go to listen to ABBA and Neil Diamond.
I like Neil Diamond, Pete says. I flash Gabe a jubilant smile as he shakes his head at Pete.
You might like Neil Diamond when you're driving around in your car, but a bar full of cougars belting out Sweet Caroline while dirty old men look on with cigars under a disco ball? Not a pretty sight.
Pete laughs and says,
That sounds like fun, actually.
Gabe looks at him for a beat, then turns to me and asks in his dry monotone,
And you still want to use his sperm?
Everyone laughs, except Meredith, who has already asked our waiter for the bill and is glancing impatiently in his direction.
It's very fun, I say, in a disco throwback to the 70s kind of way.
Half the people in there are 70, Gabe says, and 100% of them are cheesy.
Not true, I say, insisting that it's become a mixed crowd, trendy and cheesy, living in harmony.
Meredith pulls her Amex out of her wallet as she announces,
I'm with Gabe. Johnny's Hideaway is vile.
Gabe snaps and points at her and says,
Finally, we agree on something.
Well, you two can just head on home. Sid and I are going to Johnny's, I say, then ask Shauna, Leslie, and Pete if they want to join us.
Yep, I'm in,
Shauna says without hesitating, reminding me of what I used to love so much about her.
Me too, Pete says. I want to see this place.
I smile, then turn to Leslie, expecting her to decline. Instead, she nods, then bursts into the first lines of Sweet Caroline. Sid and I continue in unison.
Oh, good grief,
Gabe says. Come on, please come, I beg him. For me?
Nope, I don't do Johnny's,
Gabe announces in the same tone that someone might say, I don't do drugs. Then he turns to Pete and says,
My man, you're on your own tonight.
Just before midnight, Shauna, Sydney, Leslie, Pete, and I join the line outside Johnny's, which is housed in a nondescript building at the end of a retail strip on Roswell Road. In front of us is a loud, cackling pack of 50-something women, all wearing tight animal prints. After Sydney strikes up a conversation with them, we discover that they are attending a cougar-themed bachelorette party. The bride's sash announces that this will be her last night on the prowl. When's the big day? I ask her.
Next Saturday,
she replies, adjusting her headband, which is actually a leopard print thong.
Here's hoping third time's the charm.
We all laugh and wish her good luck, then pay the suit-clad doorman our $5 cover, making our way into the dimly lit black and red lounge, pulsing to the rhythm of Little Red Corvette. A large disco ball spins, casting glittering light onto the parquet dance floor.
Wow, this place is awesome,
Pete says, glancing at the walls, adorned with photos of celebrities, from Frank Sinatra to Arnold Palmer to Britney Spears to George Clooney, who apparently came by the club one night as he is posing with our same doorman. Told you, I proudly reply. Leslie, his fellow Johnny's virgin, nods in agreement, murmuring that Gabe's really missing out, as I tell her for about the third time how impressed I am that she came without him. It's just so cool of you, I gush, then admit that I like her more now than I thought I did at first. The sort of confessionary thing you blurt out when you're drinking.
Well, thanks, she says. Gabe told me how important you are to him, so...
Ah, so you're just being strategic? Like the way to a man's heart is through his stomach. But for Gabe, it's Josie,
Sydney asks her. Leslie laughs and says, Honestly, I just wanted to see this place.
Is it everything you hoped it would be?
I say. And more, she says as we sail through a cloud of cigar smoke and sidle up to the bar lined with red upholstered swivel chairs.
What do you girls want?
Pete asks, pushing a credit card across the bar.
Should we go with a retro cocktail? Harvey Wallbangers, Manhattans, Tequila Sunrises.
I say, you know what? I'll take a whiskey sour. Shauna makes a face and says,
I forgot how we used to drink those.
Make it two.
Sid and Leslie say they'll stick with red wine, and Pete orders a Miller Lite, starting a tab despite Shauna's insistence that he's only getting the first round. Moments later, drinks in hand, we squeeze onto the packed but demographically diverse dance floor. From hot sorority girls to Virginia Slim smoking divorcees to businessmen in crumpled suits. As the DJ spins hits from the 50s through the 90s, we dance in a sweaty cluster, occasionally merging with gyrating strangers or posing for provocative group selfies. At one point, my left breast even makes an accidental cameo. A few rounds later, as Pete and I pair off and slow dance to Poison's Every Rose Has Its Thorn, I feel a surge of happiness, although I recognize that it's probably just an alcohol and 80s music-induced euphoria. I wonder if it might be a little more than that, if maybe it might actually have something to do with Pete. I'm so happy we met, I say, smiling up at him, my arms around his waist.
Me too, he says, grinning back at me, no matter what happens with us.
Meaning what? I ask, are you backing out?
Nope, he says, expertly dipping me. I just mean regardless of what happens tonight.
I laugh and say,
wait, are you hitting on me?
Uh-huh, I think I am,
Pete says, putting his hand on my ass.
But at Johnny's, it's called making a pass. Can you dig it?
Oh, I can dig it, I say, racking my brain for 70s slang. You're such a Casanova. He gives me his cheesiest wink, then does a groovy spinning dance move.
Don't you know it, girl?
I beam up at him, then say, you know what?
What's that?
I was just thinking that you're hot. Really hot. But it's probably just the booze talking.
A drunk mind speaks a sober heart, baby,
he says, pulling me closer. Actually, I say, I don't think it's the booze. I think it's that your buzz cut is finally growing out.
Jerk, he says, pretending to be offended.
A drunk mind speaks a sober heart, I remind him, staring at the cleft in his chin. But seriously, you really do look good tonight.
Good enough to kiss me?
He asks as the DJ starts playing Jessie's Girl, one of my all-time favorites. Maybe, I say, giving him a coy smile.
Well, he says, what's it gonna be?
As Springfield bursts into his refrain, I decide to go for it. I stand on my tiptoes, lean up, and kiss him for just long enough to know that I like it.
Wow, he says as we separate, his eyes still closed. That was pretty nice.
Pretty nice, I say.
Very nice,
he says, then leans down and kisses me again. Our lips part.
Get a room,
I hear Shauna shouting behind us, bringing back college memories. I pull away from Pete, quickly wipe my mouth with the back of my hand, and say to Shauna, you didn't see that.
Did too, she says, then points at Leslie and Sid. And so did they.
It was nothing, I announced to the group. Just a little birthday kiss. Right, Pete? Pete nods in earnest agreement.
Yep, that's all it was.
I stare at him, wondering if he's bluffing or telling the truth. I decide it's likely the latter, feeling a dash of disappointment. After all, it's very difficult to let go of the lifelong dream of finding love, and at the very least, it would be nice to feel wanted. But then I remind myself of the greater picture, a bigger dream. I tell myself not to let one stupid kiss muddy the waters. That one day, it will just be a cute story to share with my daughter or son. About my 38th birthday. How one night, shortly before my insemination, I kissed her biological father on the dance floor of Johnny's Hideaway. About an hour later, after we shut the place down, no easy feat, and Sydney drops me off in her Uber car. I walk in the house, ravenously hungry, heading straight for the kitchen. As I open the refrigerator, scouring for leftovers, I hear footsteps behind me and jump, dropping a Chinese takeout box that spills all over the floor.
Hey,
I hear Gabe say. Jesus, you scared me, I say, bending down to pick up the container and a big clump of white rice. What are you doing creeping around like that?
I live here, Gabe says.
Well, still, I say, kicking off my heels, knowing that my feet aren't going to recover for days. What are you doing up?
I can't sleep.
Are you hungry?
No.
Well, I'm fucking starving, I say, swearing more than usual, as I always do after a few drinks. Do we have anything other than rice?
There should be some beef and broccoli in there, too,
he says. I look again and spot another white container behind Gabe's carton of whole milk. There it is, I say, grabbing it and putting it on the counter. Then I pull a fork out of the utensil drawer, deciding that it's not worth the effort to get a plate or put anything in the microwave. Instead, I dive straight in.
Nasty,
Gabe says under his breath. Both because he never eats cold leftovers, and because he thinks all food, even that which is consumed at 3 in the morning, should be put on a plate and eaten with a little civility. His words. Whatever, I say. You're nasty.
No, you are, he says. And you smell like an ashtray.
He gives me a knowing look, leading his witness as always. When I don't respond, he adds,
I heard you were smoking cigars tonight.
Paul Jolly was there, you know, our old neighbor. I took like one puff of his cigar. Who's your informant? I talked to Leslie.
She called you already?
I say, thinking that she left only about 20 minutes before the rest of us.
No, I called her.
Failed attempt at a booty.